moi, l'histoire des Noirs et d'une campagne de 6 mois qui vise à se solidariser avec Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik afin qu'il soit retiré de la liste 1267 de l'ONU.
Hi everyone, welcome. This event tonight is in the context of Black History Month and also a 6-month campaign to in solidarity with Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik to get his name removed from the UN 1267 list.
Alors comme programme de la soirée, bien, on va d'abord juste présenter brièvement c'est quoi l'histoire d'Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik avant de laisser la parole à nos panélistes de ce soir. Qui sont David Austin et Khalid El-Ghazar, qu'on va présenter dans quelques temps.
So, we're just going to present a little bit of Abou Soufiane's history and then leave the space for our panelists, David Austin and Khalid El-Ghazar, to talk.
Donc, on va commencer avec juste une mise en contexte de l'histoire d'Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik. Alors, Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik est un Montréalais qui en fait, si on peut dire, est victime d'une collaboration entre des fonctionnaires du Canada ici, puis dans une pratique de ce qu'on peut dire une externalisation de la torture. Et puis, il se retrouve en fait au centre d'un enjeu politique qui vise à maintenir en place tout un système de sécurité nationale qui est lié au racisme. Et c'est ça qu'on veut un peu expliquer ce soir. Toute l'histoire d'Abou Soufiane, en fait, Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik l'a amené à être séparé de sa famille, d'être dans un exil forcé durant plus de 6 ans. Alors, après avoir été l'objet de harcèlement de la part du SCRS, qui est le Service canadien de renseignement et sécurité à Montréal, Abou Soufiane Abdelrazik a été arrêté alors qu'il était en visite au Soudan en 2003, puisqu'il est canado-soudanais. Et son arrestation, alors qu'il était en visite chez de la famille au Soudan, a été faite sur les recommandations du SCRS. Alors qu'il n'avait jamais été inculpé de quoi que ce soit, Abdelrazik a été, donc dans ses périodes de détention, 2 périodes de détention, il a été battu, soumis à des sévices, été torturé. Et tout ça, ça a duré environ 1 an et demi. Et dans ce contexte, il est important de mentionner qu'il y a des agents du SCRS qui se sont rendus au Soudan et qui l'ont interrogé à l'intérieur de prison, alors que lui, il disait, ben, regardez qu'est-ce que je suis en train de vivre, est-ce que vous allez me sortir d'ici, et c'est pas ça qui s'est passé comme on dit. Alors, quand il a réussi à sortir de prison, il a été, en fait, il s'est rendu compte qu'il ne pouvait pas revenir au Canada. Donc, ses tentatives pour revenir au Canada, rappelle qu'il habite à Montréal depuis de nombreuses années, ont été systématiquement bloquées par les fonctionnaires, les officiels du Canada. Et ça, malgré que tant la GRC que le SCRS avaient émis des déclarations, avaient envoyé des déclarations au gouvernement en disant rien, on ne retient rien contre M. Abdelrazik, donc finalement, ces personnes-là, il n'y a aucune charge, aucune accusation n'a jamais été déposée. Son histoire a été rendue publique, il a rendu son histoire publique en avril 2008, alors qu'il a pris refuge à l'ambassade du Canada à Khartoum, où il a vécu pendant plus de 14 mois. C'est à ce moment-là que des personnes ici, à Montréal, bon, à Ottawa, des gens, des avocats et des personnes, des gens de groupes et d'associations, se sont engagés dans une campagne afin de soutenir son retour au Canada. Donc, le travail de base de plusieurs groupes, associations et tout ça, de gens de partout au Canada ont mené à l'achat d'un billet d'avion pour emmener M. Abdelrazik à revenir au Canada. On a finalement réussi à ce qu'il revienne le 27 juin 2009. Alors, M. Abdelrazik est de retour à la maison, mais il n'est toujours pas libre. Parce qu'en fait, il y a les situations qui s'est passées durant ces 6 années d'exil forcé. C'est que en 2006, sans qu'on l'ait mis au courant, il a été ajouté, son nom a été ajouté à une liste qui est établie par les Nations Unies, qui est en fait, qui a été établi par la résolution 1267 des Nations Unies, donc ce qu'on appelle la liste 1267, la liste d'interdiction de vol. Alors, ben ça, justement, ce soir, ça a été un petit peu l'objectif de savoir un petit peu ce à quoi ça retourne, qu'est-ce que cette liste-là, qu'est-ce que ça implique, puis en quoi, en fait, ça soutient tout un système en place au Canada. Et, bon, depuis qu'il est de retour au Canada, bien, évidemment, cette liste-là, ça lui impose une interdiction de vol, un gel des avoirs financiers, et, bon, dans la peau sur les armes, évidemment, c'est pas, et le gel des avoirs, et ce qui fait en sorte que M. Abdelazik ne peut pas travailler, ne peut pas recevoir de sous, puis, en théorie, reconnu par de quoi que ce soit, sans avoir témoigné devant un quelconque comité, sans avoir passé devant un juge. Donc, c'est un système qui est finalement hors de tout système juridique. Exactement. En terminant, ce à quoi ça nous fait réfléchir, puisque les gens du projet Retour Bercail, on est dans, on amène cette analyse, on cherche à faire des liens, en fait, avec d'autres histoires qui se déroulent. Et aujourd'hui, on a invité M. Austin à venir parler de la répression du comité des Noirs dans un autre contexte politique, mais on voit que c'est les mêmes dynamiques qui sont en œuvre.
So, many of you have probably already heard of Abdelazik Abdelrazek, but I'm just going to give a short summary. He's a victim of the shameful, one of many shameful collaborations between the Canadian officials and overseas torturers. And a political maneuvering that kept him out of Canada and in forced exile for 6 years. Abu Sufyan Abdelrazik has been living in Montreal for a long time. He's a Sudanese Canadian citizen. And after being harassed by CSIS in Montreal, he was arrested while on a visit to Sudan in 2003. And this was done on the recommendation of CSIS. CSIS is the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, you don't know. Never charged, Abdelrazik was beaten, threatened, and tortured during two periods of detention that were over a year and a half. And in this context, the same CSIS agents who had harassed him in Montreal came to visit him in Sudan and interrogate him. When he was released from prison, he was repeatedly blocked by Canadian officials from coming home to where his children are. And this is despite the fact that his name was cleared from both CSIS and the RCMP. And so in April 2008, Abu Sufyan went public with his story, and he took refuge in the Canadian embassy, where he ended up staying for 14 months in Khartoum. And this is the point when Project Fly Home came together, and part of that campaign was to, people contributed to buying a ticket for Abu Sufyan Abdelrazik, which is directly against the sanctions of the 1267 list, which you'll hear about later on in the night. So it was this groundswell of people across Canada and the strong ruling by the federal court that eventually forced the government to bring Abu Sufyan Abdelrazik home. After 6 years of exile, he returned to Canada June 27, 2009. And though he's home, his struggle's not over, because as he found out after waking up one morning, that his name, without his knowledge, was put on the UN 1267 list. And you'll see what this means, but part of it is a complete financial asset freeze and a no-fly travel ban, which clearly affects his life in multiple ways. He was put on this list without being charged. There was no judge involved. He did not know beforehand. He had no way of defending himself. And this list is completely based on association. I guess we'll turn it over to David Austin, the introduction.
Rapidement, c'est que dans la campagne qui est en cours, c'est en fait la campagne vise pour objectif de retrait de M. Abdelrazik de la liste 1267 de l'ONU. Alors, il y a des cartes postales qu'on va faire distribuer, qu'on va faire circuler pendant les présentations qui visent à, qui s'adressent en fait à Lawrence Cannon, donc ministre des Affaires étrangères, et qui, vous allez voir l'information qui va être un petit peu qui explique c'est quoi les revendications et de quelle façon le gouvernement peut agir actuellement afin que M. Abdelrazik soit retiré de la liste 1267, car comme on va l'apprendre, autant il est facile de mettre un individu sur la liste 1267, autant la les procédures pour être retiré de la liste sont quasiment, c'est impossible à réaliser. Fait que si vous voulez en prendre pour dépasser autour de vous, vous êtes prêts.
So before starting, these are postcards that are part of our 6-month campaign to get Abdelrazik of the Razik off the list. And the letters are addressed to Lawrence Cannon, who's the Minister of Foreign Affairs and who was very involved in keeping Abdelrazik from coming home, and has also refused many meetings with Abdelrazik since he's been back. So, like, we encourage you to read it, sign your name, and put it in a mailbox, or actually, you could probably leave it in a pile on the table, and we'll put it in the mailbox for you. So, thanks. So, just going to introduce David Austin. The topic he's going to talk about is Black Community Organizing and Internationalism and Canadian State Security, Lessons from the 1960s. David Austin is founder and trustee of the Alfie Roberts Institute, an independent research institute based in Montreal. He's editor of You Don't Play with Revolution, CLR James Montreal Lectures, a series of talks delivered by CLR James in Montreal in the 1960s.
Thank you. Thank you to everybody involved in organizing this event. And also thank you to Abu Sufyan Abdelrazik, who is here in the room with us, and is the reason why we're here. I think part of what I'm going to try to do today is to talk a little bit about a period in the history of the Black community, Canada's Black population, generally speaking, but particularly here in Montreal in the 1960s and 70s. And maybe to discuss both in the presentation, but especially during our discussion after the presentations, how this particular history, and particularly how it relates to security and intelligence, how it relates to the present, and maybe provide some insight for us into how security and intelligence works, and will provide hopefully some food for thought, as well as some historical context. Now, this is part of what I'm going to talk about today is the result of, I think, maybe about 16 or 17 years of, I don't want to say research, because it kind of reduces it to a process which is not entirely faithful to how I learned about much of this. The context for what I'm going to talk about today was initially passed down to me from people who are part of the community that I'm talking about here in Montreal. So in other words, initially these were oral stories that over time I sort of internalized, and at a certain point began to do my own exploring and research and investigation, which involved at that point research in the conventional sense of the word. But that's not where this process began. And I'm partly emphasizing that to say that there are all kinds of people around in this society that we live in this city that we live in, that have stories that are extremely important and valuable that should be shared. And my personal experience has been that when people like that move on, their stories generally go with them because they remain unrecorded. So I've kind of come to the conclusion over the last little while that much of what I'm going to talk about and how I've been thinking about this process kind of needs to be framed in this notion of citizenship that we live with, which conveys the sense that people who are citizens, in this case Canadian citizens, are entitled to certain entitlements, which those who are not citizens or perceived as not being citizens, even though they may formally be citizens, are not entitled to. Right? And those entitlements or privileges are very much framed by a dominant ideology or logic, which we can talk about, I think, at some point. But part of what it does is provide this illusion that protest and dissent is possible in our society. In practice, whenever protest or dissent seems to threaten the interests of those who have an interest in protecting the interests of Canadian society, whatever that means, right? Very confusing, right? We realize that in practice, we're perhaps not as free as we think we are, or should be. Sorry for being so convoluted. I hope it will make sense at some point, okay? So, in the late 1950s and in the 1960s, hundreds and thousands of women and men from the Caribbean migrated to Montreal and other cities in Canada. Some came as domestic workers working in the homes of Canadian farmers, ostensibly white Canadian farmers. Some came as students studying at universities like Concordia or McGill, mostly those two, maybe one or two or a few at some of the two French universities, but mostly at Concordia and McGill. These are Anglophones I'm referring to for the most part at this stage. And some came as professionals. Right? They were teachers, they were educated in one form or another, some educated abroad in England or in the Caribbean. So they had certain skills that were desirable in Canada at the time, desirable to officials of Canada. And many of the domestic workers who came, these women came to work in people's homes, they were providing a service which allowed those who they were working for to have a certain amount of leisure time in their lives. So what I'm getting at is that all of these folks, whether they came here as students and then remained in Canada as professionals contributing to Canadian society, whether they came here as professionals, or even those who came here as domestic workers, in some cases especially those who came here as domestic workers, they had a use value. Okay? They were making a contribution to the state that in some ways other Canadians could not or perceived as being not able to make or to contribute. So they were accepted for the most part, provided that they were able to conform and to assimilate. But most of them, in fact, you could say in a certain sense, all of them were not able to be integrated into this society for some very obvious reasons. The main thing being that there was already a narrative of what it meant to be Canadian. These folks, as immigrants, did not fit within that narrative. And that narrative was one dominant narrative that you can divide into two, right? This idea of the two solitudes, right? English and French, separate but somewhat equal, although I think French Quebecers would at that time and perhaps now disagree with the equality part. And in many ways, in fact, in actual fact, these two groups, in literary terms, if you've read Hugh MacLennan's The Two Solitudes, which I only read very recently, right, there are these frequent references. The book written in 1945. There are these ongoing references to the two races, okay? Not just two distinct groups, two distinct linguistic communities, but actually referring to two different races, right? So within that narrative of two races, French and English, right, there was no room, I think, for another race or additional races, right? So because I can't resist the pun, I'll say that these other races were left out of the race. Bad sense of humor. Okay. So basically, these new immigrants were supposed to be invisible, right? Or if seen, not heard. But their physical presence, among other things, made that impossible. They obviously looked different from other Canadians. Now, of course, there's this mythology about English Canada and French Canada, when English Canada also obviously includes Scots, Irish, and many other people who are not actually English, and also came from countries or territories that were exploited by the British, right? So that's part of the reality too, and that's also part of the mythology. But those groups were integratable in ways that other groups who look different could not be, okay? But in addition to looking different, right, they began to raise their voices and protest against this silent presence of race, right? Because Canada was not supposed to have, aside from the English and French, was not supposed to have a kind of race problem, right? So, again, going back to Hugh MacLennan's book, he talks about the English and French races, right? Indigenous people are not mentioned at all. Now, this is Canada's classic novel. Indigenous people are not mentioned at all. And black Canadians are not mentioned at all, although there are several references to people of African descent or black. And they're far from positive. I don't know, I'll just leave that at that. And they're not Canadian blacks, by the way. They're from Barbados or some other place. So there's no sense that there are black people living in Canada. Now, Hugh MacLennan wrote his book in 1945, so it's prior to this wave of immigration, but the point is that there were hundreds of black people living in Montreal long before that, going many generations, right? As well as blacks in Nova Scotia going back 200 plus years, right? Plus the fact that, plus the existence of slavery in Canada, which is one of those other sort of silent omissions. So this is a kind of context in which this group of Caribbean women and men came to Canada and came to Montreal in particular and began to organize themselves around a couple of questions. Initially around the question of Caribbean liberation, Caribbean independence. They were coming from a region in which there were only, at the time, by 1906, there were four Caribbean territories that were independent: Barbados, Jamaica, Guyana, and Trinidad and Tobago. Right? So many of these folks were coming from countries that were still colonies of Britain. So they were agitating for independence. Others came from countries that were independent, those that I mentioned. But these were countries that were seen as being independent in theory, but not in practice. So they were agitating for change in terms of that situation, too. And I won't go into too much details about that. I'll try and keep this as relatively short as possible. Okay, so that's the kind of context in which these folks were organizing. And they were part of a group initially called the Conference Committee on West Indian Affairs, and the Caribbean Conference Committee, which then morphed into several other groups, including the Caribbean International Service Bureau. Okay, so having said that, I'm going to read from, well, I won't tell you what I'm reading from. That's part of the point. I'm going to see if you can actually figure out what I'm reading from when I'm finished. probably figure it out before I'm finished. Okay. The Caribbean International Service Bureau, which is the last manifestation of those groups that I mentioned, appears to have emerged following the Black Writers Congress held in Montreal in 1968. However, it did not come to the active notice until until 1972, when it was evident that the CISB, the Caribbean International Service Bureau, was planning an international Caribbean conference under the direction of, and there's a blank space, that's the first hint, to groups that sponsored the conference towards the colonial, towards the continuing decolonization of the Caribbean, May 4th to 6th, 1973, in Montreal. It was also responsible for the Pan-Caribbean Revolutionary Conference held in St. Lucia at the end of April 1973, which was a preliminary meeting for the major international conference to be held at a later date. And it goes on to list the objectives of the organization. And then it says, in recent months, there has been no reference to the CISB as such, and in the view of an evidence split that has developed between, and there's two blank spaces there, it is unlikely that this group still functions in its original form. The objectives of the CISB are probably now being pursued by blank space and whatever organization emerges to carry on with the Pan-Caribbean Revolutionary Congress, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to go on to another. So this is another document. Some rather energetic plans are being made by black nationalist functionaries located in Canada. A most definitive pattern has surfaced between forces in Canada, USA, and the Caribbean. It would appear that the role of blacks in Canada will be paramount in attempting to strengthen the arm of a black revolutionary movement. He appears to be in a position of leadership and capable of rallying an interesting cross-section of black revolutionary figures. We have a very special interest in the organizing of the Caribbean International Service Bureau and all the key figures involved. The reporting on this new development has been most encouraging and will serve to strengthen recent briefs prepared on rapidly changing developments of security interests and concern. I guess you're probably, the hint is getting stronger. The attached paper reflects the progress being made by certain black revolutionary organizations in Canada towards setting up a viable force aimed in principle at supporting black revolutionary groups in the Caribbean. It appears that serious plans are now underway to organize a Caribbean conference under the direction of the newly formed Caribbean International Service Bureau based in Montreal, with influence coming from, and there's a big blank space, and the Interreligious Foundation of Community Organizations, IFCO, USA, another, which is an important left religious organization of the time. We are continuing our investigation into these latest developments. It is most interesting to note that the involvement of a blank space in recent organizational activity in Canada, and it goes on to talk about this person's work. And then the last thing I'll read is a list of members of this group called the Caribbean International Service Bureau. Okay. So the document says the original membership of the Caribbean International Service Bureau consists of Franklin Valentine Peter Harvey from Grenada, Toronto, Ann Cools from Barbados. Now, Ann Cools, by the way, is a senator. This is Senator Ann Cools, who was initially a liberal senator, but a couple of years ago crossed the floor and is now a conservative senator. But she's mentioned in this document at this time. Theodore Alfonso Roberts, St. Vincent and Montreal. Robert Abraham Henry Hill from Jamaica, United States. Carolyn Thick from the United States and Montreal, who now teaches at Concordia. Tim, believed to be Leonard Timothy Hector from Antigua, and there are several other people. And also says that these individuals were basically the CLRGM study circle. The CISB membership was subsequently enlarged to include several other members who are listed. Does anybody know who CLRGM is or was? C.L.R. James was a Caribbean political theorist, novelist, cultural critic, sports commentator. This kind of goes on. Who is now increasingly considered one of the original thinkers of the 20th century. But in those days was a kind of ailing Caribbean radical from Trinidad who members of this group adopted as their mentor in order to help them think through this question of what social transformation means and how it can be thought about in relation to the Caribbean. And he spent quite a bit of time here in Montreal and in Canada in the late 1960s. So it makes sense that the document that I just read from would note this group, this circle that was centered around James and mentioned C.L.R. James himself. So what am I reading from?
RCMP.
The RCMP files, sure. And this is, these are three documents here, but they're three of hundreds of documents on this group alone. And if you were to see the list of documents on a range of groups, French Quebecois left groups, feminist groups, women's groups, gay and lesbian groups, etc. The list goes on. There are copious notes and extensive records on these groups. Right? So somebody was watching very closely the RCMP. Now, out of this process, there's something very interesting that happened. Now, there was a person who befriended members of this group much later in the 1960s, I'm kind of truncating the story in interest of time, who was originally from the United States. In fact, he was from Baltimore, and rose to the level of captain in the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party in the late 1960s. His name was Warren Hart. And sometime around 1970, he found himself in Montreal and became the bodyguard driver of a person named Rosie Douglas, who was central to all these activities. He was one of the leading figures that was involved in the Sir George Williams affair. I'm sure some of you are familiar with the protests that happened at Concordia in 1969 when some students complained that a professor was failing them in the classroom systematically. And it ended up being this huge protest, an occupation of the ninth floor of the computer center, which in addition to being a black-led protest, a widespread protest on this question of race and racism in Canada. Right? It's in many ways the most significant student protests in Canada of the 1960s in terms of its breadth and in terms of its impact in Canadian society. And it's probably the least spoken about and least written about. Rosie Douglas was at the center of this activity and was also one of the organizers of the Congress of Black Writers that took place the year before. Now, he went to prison for his involvement in the Sir George Williams affair, spent, I think, about 18 months in prison, in a penitentiary, I think, in Kingston. And when he came out, he became this kind of cause célèbre. He became, in some ways, Canada's equivalent of Stokely Carmichael from the United States. And they actually were very close friends. They both died being the closest of friends, best friends. So this captain, Warren Hart, captain of the Black Panther, the Baltimore Black Panther chapter, the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party, arrives in Montreal and becomes Rosie Douglas' bodyguard and is traveling across the country with Rosie Douglas and between Canada and the Caribbean with Rosie Douglas. Now, Rosie was, in addition to being seen as a leader of black folks in Canada, also had very close ties to indigenous groups in Canada. Very, very close ties. In fact, it was less a relationship of solidarity and more one of being actively involved in indigenous struggles. And Warren Hart also became connected to indigenous groups across the country, literally from Nova Scotia to BC, and attempted to train members of the Red Power Movement, right? And what was perceived, as you see from the kind of alarmist language in these documents, what was perceived to be Canada's Black Power Movement, which is not to say there wasn't some truth to it, but a lot of it is exaggerated and blown out of proportion to make a point, right? And a lot of it also comes from misunderstanding the very communities that they're studying and investigating. He was training, or attempted to train, these groups in ways of carrying out acts of sabotage, blowing up pipelines, using weapons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And very predictably, he turned out to be an FBI agent on loan to the RCMP, whose goal was to destabilize these groups, okay, so that the RCMP could then come in and arrest them. Now, this is all recorded and documented, and we know about this because Warren Hart was supposed to be given Canadian citizenship, right? Going back to what I said earlier, but for whatever reasons, he was somehow seen unentitled to Canadian citizenship. I don't know what he did or what he didn't do, but and when he was deported, this agent on loan to the RCMP was deported by the RCMP. He spilled the beans to an MP in federal parliament, and as is the tradition in this great country, there was a commission was launched, a royal commission. A royal commission was launched, called the MacDonald Commission. And over a period of about 2 years, this commission, it was an investigation, and you know, we could call this story the tale of two Warrens, because Warren Hart was also investigating Warren Allman, who I think most of you know, a former MP, right, former city councilor, who at the time was the attorney general, and the RCMP perceived him as being a communist, so they were investigating him too, right, and they used Warren Hart and Rosie Douglas' connection to Warren Allman, who Rosie was trying to convince Warren Allman that he should not be deported. And Warren Hart was there, trying to recording their conversations in an attempt to somehow implicate Warren Allman in some kind of nefarious business. So this all came out during this commission. Made national and international headlines because Hart was also traveling with Rosie Douglas, attempting to teach groups in the Caribbean, best groups in the Caribbean, the same kind of military strategies he was trying to impose on groups here in Canada. Now, I guess my point in raising all of this is to suggest that, you know, we kind of have this tradition of behaving as though everything is new. So we always seem to be shocked when we hear cases of injustice, when somebody's being denied their rights, you know, whether it be as a citizen or as an immigrant or as a refugee. And I think historical context is extremely important. And there's a need, you know, this is really a small piece of this work, just about the RCMP's investigation of this group. And there are all these other pieces, not only about this group, but about other groups and other organizations, which give us some insight, I think, into how intelligence works, and sometimes how unintelligently intelligence works. And we need to know this stuff if we want to be able to understand how negatively this particular kind of intelligence can impact people's lives. And I think it's also important for groups that are politically active. If you see the list of groups that were being spied upon, I mean, some of these groups are, you know, innocent groups. I mean, almost a group of old women having a tea party. But any group that seemed to somehow contravene or challenge this notion of citizenship and to come into, negatively come into contact with the dominant narrative of what it means to be Canadian, which is not only racialized, it's also shaped by this notion that Canada is a peaceful nation, right, that sort of lives innocently somewhere between the traditions of Britain and the United States. Right? When we know, of course, if we begin just with the history of indigenous people in this country, that's just pure mythology. Right? If you think about the Caribbean, Canada in relation to the Caribbean, which was uppermost in the mind of many of these people when they were active in this country, these were folks who had grown up in countries in the Caribbean where most of the banks, where they did their personal banking, were Canadian banks. And the major industry in places like Jamaica and Guyana was Alcan, which manufactures aluminum foil, which comes from bauxite, right, which is produced right here in Quebec, Saguenay-Lac Saint-Jacques. Okay. So I guess in some respects I'm kind of making a bit of a plea, to talk to some of these folks that have these stories, right? Because these stories are context for where we are today. And also, for those of us who have the time and the energy and the will, is to suggest that we need to do a bit of research so we don't fall into that trap of thinking and behaving as though what we're seeing today in terms of how security and intelligence works is new. Because it provides us with insight into the lengths to which security and intelligence is willing to go, right, to disrupt the lives of innocent people. Because all of these folks who are being followed and studied by the RCMP at this point. Oh, and by the way, I kind of stopped half sentence. That commission, at the end of that commission, the commissioner McDonald made a recommendation that because of the nefarious practices of the RCMP, that they should no longer be able to carry out intelligence or spying. Right. So out of that process, CSIS was actually formed because it was decided that the RCMP shouldn't do that work because of the way they've been doing it. So the work of this group had direct bearing on the shape of security intelligence today. But we need to study how the RCMP functioned during that period to have some sense, some idea of the lengths to which they're willing to go to disrupt the lives of innocent people. As I was saying, these folks were protesting, they were raising questions about race, raising questions about class, or raising questions about Canada's international ties, particularly to the Caribbean. But they were honest questions. They were deliberate questions. They were questions that challenged authorities. But they were honest questions, and of course they were legal questions. So the lives of innocent people were disrupted and turned upside down in order to protect perceived interests of the state. So again, I'd like to make a plea that there's a lot more work to be done in this area. There are files on top of files in the RCMP archives, the CSIS archives. Now, a lot of this stuff has been declassified from the 1960s and 70s, although a lot of the material is littered with blank spaces. So as I was reading through the documents, here, as I said, blank space here and there, all these documents have blank spaces. But with a little imagination, you can read between the lines and have a clear sense of who they're speaking about and why they're speaking about. So I think I'll stop there.
So I'm gonna introduce Khalid Al-Ghazal, who I think is familiar as Abdulrazik's, one of Abdulrazik's lawyers is familiar with the blank spaces in documents from the government and thesis in RTMB. He's going to talk about the United Nations 1267 terrorist blacklist and Abdulrazik's case. He's an Ottawa-based lawyer who specializes in civil litigation, civil liberties law. He is part of the legal team that is representing Abu Sufyan, or that represented Abu Sufyan in the matters of Abdulrazik versus the Minister of Foreign Affairs, which is the case that led to Abdulrazik's return to Montreal.
Hey, everyone. Okay. So, as you heard in the introduction, Abu Sufyan was in the Sudan. He left Canada in 2003. And during his, he left because, and I'll sort of get into more of the details about his story earlier, but just as a preface to what I'm going to say about 1267, he was detained in the Sudan twice for a total of almost 2 years. During his detention, he was severely treated, he was tortured, and I'm sort of saying he stepped out of the room. So he was tortured, mistreated, and he was interrogated by not only Sudanese intelligence agents, but Canadian intelligence agents who have since cleared him of any wrongdoing, and who, and he's never been charged in Canada or elsewhere. Abu Sufyan was repatriated to Canada last year, and although he is now free from detention in Sudan, he is still, in a sense, imprisoned by what I'll call the prison of the 1267 regime. It's been referred to as a prison without walls. So what I'm going to do is I'll try to describe a little bit of the 1267 regime, some of the ins and outs, as quickly as I can. And then I'll try to intertwine that with some of the facts that are specific to Abu Sufyan's case. So he didn't know it at the time, but Abu Sufyan's story as it relates to being blacklisted by the 1267 committee began in the summer of 1998. When two U.S. embassies in Africa, one in Nairobi, Kenya, and one in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, were bombed allegedly by Osama bin Laden. So after the bombings, I believe it was the United States that requested the extradition of Osama bin Laden, who was then believed to be in Afghanistan. At the time, the de facto government of Afghanistan was the Taliban. So faced with a request to extradite Osama bin Laden, the Taliban refused. They said that we're not turning him over. As such, the United Nations, the Security Council of the United Nations, decided that they were going to develop a sanctions regime aimed at the Taliban. So that sanctions regime was created by Security Council Resolution 1267 in 1999, and that's why we call it the 1267 regime, the 1267 list, etc. So when I refer to 1267, it means the committee or the regime that was created originally to implement sanctions against the Taliban. So the sanctions that were implemented by 1267 in 1999 essentially banned member states of the United Nations from allowing Taliban aircraft to land and take off from their airfields, from their territory, and also to freeze the assets of the Taliban that were within their territory. As part of the regime, 1267, the Security Council established a committee called the 1267 Committee that was to administer this regime. Now, as you may know, the Security Council, which is essentially the core of power at the United Nations, has 15 members. Five of them are permanent members and 10 of them rotate. The committee of the 1267 is made up of the same members. It's 15 members, all from the Security Council. So it's essentially the same thing as the Security Council. What made 1267 a little different from previous sanctions regimes is that for one of the first times, and maybe the first time in UN history, it was targeting not a state, but it was targeting a regime and later on individuals. And that's what makes this different, is that 1267 targets, its sanctions that target individuals. Abu Sufyan being one of them. After September 11th, 2001, 1267 was broadened to include not only the Taliban, but also to include Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, any of their associates of Taliban. And the sanctions themselves were also broadened to include not only an asset freeze, but a travel ban. So in other words, anyone that was on the list, the consolidated list, which was another part of the regime, was subject to a travel ban, so they couldn't travel. And I'll explain that in a second. So in order to administer the 1267 regime, they needed a list of entities and individuals, and that's what I call the 1267 list. So there's a list of people. You can find it on the internet. If you do a Google search on 1267 list, you'll see a list of about 500 people, those associated or allegedly associated with Taliban, those allegedly associated with bin Laden, those allegedly associated with Al-Qaeda. So in order to be listed, all that is required is for a state to advance or to forward the name of an individual or an entity or a group that it wants listed. So any state can approach the 1267 Committee of the United Nations and say, you know, here's an individual, not necessarily from their own country. So here's an individual that we think is associated in some way with one of the entities, Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, Taliban. Here's some information we have about them. We request that you list them. And now the process for getting added onto the list is relatively simple. The committee accepts the submission. They look at it, and in almost all cases, they just add the person to the list. So getting on the list is really easy. As we'll see in a few minutes, getting off the list is nearly impossible. Now, you don't have to be a criminal to be on the list. You don't have to have been charged with a criminal offense. And in most cases, people haven't been. And for example, in the case of Abu Sufyan, he's never been charged with any offense, let alone convicted. The standard for being listed is that you are suspected of being associated with one of the entities, whether it be the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. So you can be, and this is the scary thing, this is what one of the things that makes this regime appalling is that it can be based on suspicion alone that you be listed. Okay? So the standard isn't, for example, as in the criminal standard, which is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or the civil standard, which is on the balance of probabilities, you're liable. No, it's just suspicion. We suspect, right? So what's the effect of listing? As I alluded to earlier, there's an asset freeze that applies to people who are listed. There's a travel ban and an arms embargo. For the purposes of our discussion today, I'm not really going to touch upon the arms embargo, but the asset freeze and the travel ban are more significant. So the 1267 has implemented this regime, and as part of their obligations as members of the United Nations, all states who are members of the United Nations have an obligation to implement that regime into domestic law. So in Canada, for example, there's an obligation on Canada as a member of the United Nations to implement that sanctions regime into Canadian law, and it has been implemented in Canadian law. There is a regulation that's been passed pursuant to the United Nations Act. The United Nations Act is Canadian legislation that essentially implements these restrictions on people who are listed by the 1267 Committee. So, in terms of the travel ban, essentially you're not allowed to travel. It's pretty simple. You're not allowed to travel through the territory. You're not allowed to transit through the territory of member states. That's how it goes. Now, there are some exceptions. One of them is if you're allowed to travel, if it's to return to your country of citizenship or nationality or residence. You're allowed to travel for the fulfillment of a judicial proceeding. So let's say you're being tried in some country, then you can travel for that purpose. And you can also apply for a case-by-case exemption to travel. And that will become relevant when I talk about Abu Sufyan's battle to come back from Sudan earlier. As far as the asset freeze is concerned, it basically means that any assets that a listed person has, they're frozen. You have no access to, let's say you had a bank account, no more. If you had a job, it's now illegal for your boss to pay you. If you want to donate money to a person, arguably that's an offense under Canadian law. If you want to donate money to a listed person. Right? So they essentially, the aim of this regime is to essentially cut off listed people from mobility and from any means of subsistence. Right? Unless they apply for certain exemptions. But the idea is that you're cut off. And keep in mind, you're listed based on suspicion. You can be listed as easily as we suspect that he may be associated with. Okay? Now, when you're listed, you're not told that you're going to be listed. You're not given a warning. There's no, we've received this information about you. Here it is. Why don't you give us your side of the story? None of that. There's no hearing. You just wake up one morning and your life has changed. You're on this list. And that's that. Now, getting off the list is a different story, and I'll speak to it as quickly as I can. In order to get off the list, all 15 members of the committee, i.e. the Security Council, have to agree to the delisting request. Okay. Now keep in mind, this isn't a judicial process. This isn't a process where there are rules that say, for example, if a person meets ABC criteria, they will be delisted. This is a political body. This is a body where there are countries that are, there's the United States, there's Russia, China, Germany. These are countries that have political interests. And it's a highly politicized body that is making decisions about whether to delist someone. And one example I'll give you is that last year, there was a person who was listed who was a high-ranking member of the Taliban. And he recently switched sides. He started working with the Americans. So all of a sudden, he's a good guy, and the Americans want him off the list. So they forward a request. They want him off the list. Russia says no. No, you can't get off the list. So the guy's on the list. Should he be on? Should he be off? Whatever. But the idea is it's very hard to get off the list. Any one of the members can say no, and that's it. You're stuck. There are dead people on the list. There are two people in Canada who are currently, two Canadians who are currently on the list. There is Abu Sufyan. And the second one is Ahmed Saeed Khadr, who is Omar Khadr's father, who is, as you know, dead. So that's, in a nutshell, the 1267 regime. And I'll sort of get back to some of the problems with it. But I'd like to sort of fast forward. I took you to sort of around 2001. That's when this regime, it started in 99, was revamped a bit in 2001. It's been modified, since then. As recently as a few months ago, it's been modified. So now we go to 2003. Abu Sufyan decides, for a couple of reasons, namely the fact that his mother is ill in Sudan and he's being intensely harassed by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, he decides that he wants to travel to the Sudan, primarily to visit his ailing mother, but also to escape harassment from the Security Intelligence Services. So in March 2003, Abu Sufyan travels to the Sudan. A few months later, in September 2003, he's detained by the Sudanese, arbitrarily. He's detained and he's arrested. He's not charged. He's never been charged. Abu Sufyan spends 11 months in prison, during which time he's tortured. During that stint of imprisonment, which began in September of 2003, CSIS interrogated him. So the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, who doesn't have enough evidence, or I guess the Canadians, who don't have enough evidence to charge him in Canada, purportedly at least, and there's evidence that shows, requested his detention in the Sudan and then interrogated him there. Something they couldn't do here. In any event, Abu Sufyan is released in July 2004 after 11 months of imprisonment. He makes numerous attempts to return to Canada. All of them are thwarted, sometimes by the Canadian government. Even the government of Sudan offered to fly him back, and that wasn't, and the Canadian government didn't cooperate. October 2005, Abu Sufyan is arrested again. This time, arrested again and not charged. This time, he spends 9 months in prison, again mistreated. He's released on July 20th, 2006. On that very same day, July 20th, 2006, Abu Sufyan is designated by the U.S. Treasury Department as allegedly being a high-level or a person that has high-level ties to Al-Qaeda the day of his release. So note the timing. I highly doubt it's a coincidence. The very next day, he's listed by the U.S. Department of State as a person posing significant risk. And then a few days after that, he's listed by the 1267 committee on the UN 1267 blacklist. And so now the 1267 committee has their claws in him, essentially. He's now subject to a travel ban. Now that he's released from prison in the Sudan, he's still stuck there because he's now subject to a travel ban, asset freeze, and arms embargo. Again, the arms embargo we're not concerned with. Now, as I said before, there are exceptions to the travel ban, right? So a person is entitled to travel back to their country of residence, their country of citizenship. So Abu Sufyan tries to assert his right to travel back. He says, you know, I have a right to travel back to Canada. It's my country of citizenship. The government of Canada takes the position that, no, you can't, because by traveling back to Canada, there's no way you can make it, geographically speaking. There's no way you can come back to Canada without crossing through the territory of some UN member state, whether it's the territorial waters or the airspace. And therefore, you can't come back. So what ensues is a lengthy legal battle whereby Abu Sufyan challenges that assertion made by the Canadian government. And as you know, last year, the federal court agreed with our position, with Abu Sufyan's position, and ordered that the government repatriate him almost immediately. So that was a big victory for Abu Sufyan. So he's back with us, but that doesn't change the fact that he's still on the UN 1267 list. So now the travel ban is less an issue. It's an issue. I mean, you can't travel. But the asset freeze is now a primary concern, right? Because now any assets that he has or had are frozen. He has no access to them, right? And you can't, if you worked, he couldn't be paid without an exception or an exemption. He'd have to apply every time to the UN Security Council for an exemption. Can you imagine? Keep in mind, based on suspicion, all of this is he still hasn't seen the evidence. We still don't know exactly what it is. He hasn't had a chance to challenge it. So what this essentially means for Abu Sufyan is that he is in a type of prison, right? I mean, he can walk around Montreal, but he can't work. His assets are frozen. You, under Canadian law, arguably would be committing an offense by collecting money for him. Yeah. So again, he's never been charged. He's never been convicted, but he's subject to all of these draconian measures. So I'm just going to go through some of the clearly problematic legal issues with this regime. And I should say that the court, in its decision last year, the federal court, severely rebuked the 1267 regime itself and essentially said it was an affront to human rights law and international law generally. And I'll explain some of the reasons why. First of all, targeted individuals, they're not informed prior to their listing, as I said earlier. They're not given the opportunity to challenge the listing before they're listed. For example, if you're charged with a crime in Canada, you're told that you're being charged with a crime. Here's the process. You're entitled to a lawyer. Here's all the documents we have, all of the disclosure that we can give you. Here's the burden of that we have to meet to prove that you're guilty, not the other way around. You don't have to prove your innocence. I have to prove your guilt if I'm the prosecutor. Right? And then if all of that, you know, works out and we have a trial, etc., and you're found guilty, then the punishment comes. In this case, you're sentenced before you're ever charged. It's over. You're on the list. And you don't even know about it. Okay, so what that means essentially is that you're presumed guilty. You have to prove your innocence. And that's nearly impossible to do, and I'll explain why. Whether the committee grants a delisting request or doesn't grant a delisting request is completely within its jurisdiction. And again, I point out that it's a highly politicized environment. It's not a court. It's a political body, and they've got political interests. And so they don't always make decisions based on the rule of law. They make decisions based on their own best interests. Now, the 1267 list... I should say that a little while back, is everyone familiar with the security certificate process? Sharkawi and those cases? Anyways, there's a security certificate process whereby people who are not Canadian citizens who reside in Canada can be essentially detained indefinitely and deported based on secret evidence that they are allegedly associated with terrorist entities overseas, etc., terrorist activities. The Supreme Court of Canada struck down, I think it was last year, I don't know how long ago, last year or 2 years ago in Sharkawi, struck down that process as being unconstitutional for a number of reasons. Even that process that was struck down by the Supreme Court of Canada had a limited right to a hearing. At least you'd have some kind of hearing, even though it was an unfair hearing, you'd have some kind of right to a hearing to try to face the allegations that were against you. And that was struck down by the Supreme Court. This process doesn't even have a hearing. There's no forum for you to make your arguments. You're not entitled to a hearing, right? And that's one of the, when I use the term due process, there's a concept called natural justice and procedural fairness, which requires that before someone is punished for something, that they be entitled to procedural protections, right? And procedural procedures that will protect the person's rights so that they're not unlawfully punished or punished without due cause and without course. And one of those things is a right to a hearing. Another one of those things is that you generally, in due process, you have the right to receive reasons for a decision that has a negative effect on you. So, for example, if you're in a criminal trial and the court says, we think you're guilty, well, they should provide you with reasons. There will be we think you're guilty because of the following, A, B, C, and D. The evidence shows, this is the evidence, etc., we believe it, etc. This, there is no reason. If you don't get a real reason for being listed, you never see the evidence. And as far as delisting goes, if you make a request, there's no obligation for the committee to give you reasons why it decided to delist or not to delist. And it never does provide those reasons. So you don't know. You have no idea what's going on there. Yeah. The committee's guidelines requires that a person who submits a delisting request, so to be taken off the list, that person should provide justification for the delisting request and must explain why they no longer meet the criteria for listing. So you have to prove you're innocent. They don't have to prove that you're guilty. You have to prove you're innocent. That's proving a negative. It's nearly impossible to do. That's like, for example, me saying, let's say someone alleges that I'm associated with Mr. Austin. Okay? So I have to prove that I'm not associated with Mr. Austin. How do I do that? I've got to go through every single day of my life and prove that I didn't meet Mr. Austin? As opposed to them saying, no, we have proof that you are associated with Mr. Austin. Here it is. On this day, whatever. No, but you have to prove a negative. It's nearly impossible. So this sort of goes to the heart of the idea that it's extremely hard to be taken off this list. Okay. Actually, the judge of the federal court, when he was writing his decision, made a comment about that particular issue. He said that you can no more prove that you're not associated with Al-Qaeda and Taliban than you could prove that fairies and goblins don't exist. Like, how do you prove fairies and goblins don't exist? Right? You can't, really. I mean, they could. Right? I mean, you might have a theory. As he drinks from a cup with a cow on him. I'm not crazy. But it's true. Like, how do you prove a negative? You can't, really. So, and then again, I'm sort of underlining this issue over and over again. All of this is not based on a judicial process. It's based on a politicized process where you don't have a right to a hearing, you don't have a right to see the evidence, you don't have a right to test that evidence before you're listed. And all of it can be based on suspicion of being associated with. It's completely tenuous and it's appalling. So that's what brings us here today. It's just the point of my talk, at least, was to bring to your attention the regime itself, the effect that it's having on Abu Sufyan, and it's having an effect on other people as well, of course, in different countries. And I guess with a plea that, A, we inform ourselves about these types of issues, and B, that we take positive steps to let the government know, and you may not agree with me, but if you do, and if you agree that this is appalling, and if you agree with the federal court that this is a breach of human rights law, of international law, it's appalling, it's an aberration, anyways, it's a really terrible system, then take some action, right? And I mean, there are lots of people here, there are flyers, all kinds of stuff that you can pick up on the way out if you want to get involved with this issue in particular, but at the very least, I encourage you to inform yourself about what's happening and then take some action with respect to contacting. I mean, the government's acting on your behalf and on my behalf, so I think it's incumbent upon us to make our views known to them. So again, Abu Sufyan remains a prisoner of the 1267 regime, and of course, I hope that you'll join us in the battle to have him delisted. And I guess I'll end it there. If there are any questions, we can deal with those in court.
Patricia Coelho to come and speak to us tonight to tell her story. She unfortunately couldn't come. She's down in the United States with her husband. So she asked if we could say a few words about their situation and pass around a petition on their behalf. And we were very happy to do so because it's a story that bridges these two parts of the history in a very coherent way. Natircia is married to Douglas Freeman. He's an African American who's lived in Canada for most of his life. He's for 30 years, in fact. He's married and he has his children in Toronto. And a few years ago, a number of us were contacted by Natircia. His wife asked him for our support in Montreal, and she came and gave a presentation in Montreal about their situation. And basically what had happened is in 2004, Gary Freeman was arrested suddenly outside the library where he worked as a librarian. And he was put in jail and told that he was facing extradition to the United States for an incident that had happened in 1969 in Chicago involving a white police officer. Now, just the context of 1969 Chicago, Dave alluded to it a little bit, and the situation at that time was one of extreme repression of the black rights movement, and Chicago was a place where it came out later that there was, for example, just one of many examples, there was secret Chicago police security program called the Red Squads. The Red Squad's job was to disrupt and destroy political and community groups. They had a program whose task it was to neutralize groups, to expose, cause to cease or to change in direction, groups that it called antisocial. And a lot of those groups were black community groups fighting for equality and for an end to racism. And just another example, there was a committee formed at the time. There were so many people being killed by the police, assassinated by the police, that there was a committee formed called the Committee to End the Murder of Black People in Chicago at the same time that this incident occurred. And the police officer who was involved in this incident in which Gary Freeman was alleged to be involved, he was playing an active role in the Red Squad, in the secret program to neutralize some of the community groups. And he was on a mission to find Gary Freeman, who he thought was involved in this incident involving him. So 30 years later, he managed to convince people in the U.S. to act, even though they had known that Gary was here in Canada since 1974. This police officer convinced the American government to move and demand Gary Freeman's extradition to the United States. Gary spent 3 years and 7 months fighting his extradition to the States. He was imprisoned during that whole time. He eventually was extradited, and he accepted a plea bargain which would allow him to come back in as short a time as possible. So he basically accepted 30 days in jail and 2 years in probation. When he finished that, he immediately started trying to come back to Canada, and he was told by Canada that he is not being allowed to come back to Canada, that he's inadmissible for being a threat to national security. Why? Because they're saying he was a member of the Black Panther Party. He says he wasn't. And they're saying that the Black Panther Party is a terrorist organization. So they're using contemporary immigration national security measures to block Gary from now coming back to Canada after all of this that he's already faced. So I'd encourage everyone to find out more. There's a flyer here that Gary and his family have put together. And there's a petition, and if you could sign the petition, I'll pass it around the room, that would be great. And if you're in a position to grab a few petitions and circulate them and get this, that's the main action that they're asking us to take right now to support them.
Just quickly, before we move on to questions, Maria Forte, who's also from Project Fly Home, is going to talk about getting listed and the connections, which I think we've already alluded to, between racism and the concept of national security.
First of all, I wanted to thank David Austin and Halleck for coming and speaking tonight. You guys were really great. And I think a lot of what I'm going to be saying, David Austin already mentioned, there's a certain logic that he was talking about. You were calling it the dominant ideology that underlies a lot of these different incidences. And when we look at them all together, they stop seeming so isolated. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and I'm going to keep it really short because I think a lot of people have said some of the basic ideas that I'm going to touch on already. So I'm going to talk about the concrete act of getting listed, and I also want to see lists as tools used by the Canadian state to keep track of and control people that it has deemed undesirable. And overall, I want to question who's included and who's not included as part of the nation, and thus as part of the community that the state is trying to keep safe when it talks about national security. In this country, national security has been used to control immigration because undesirable outsiders are considered a threat to the Canadian nation and its real citizens. And I'm going to talk about a few broad examples of ways that the Canadian government is founded upon and consistently follows through with processes that suspend individuals' rights for the sake of the nation's selective security. I'm also going to talk about ways that the state takes advantage of racist stereotypes to justify violent internment, deportation, and exclusion of targeted communities. David Austin mentioned this too, but I want to emphasize that it's really important to ground this whole talk about nations and security by considering Canada as a settler nation. Canada is fundamentally constituted through land theft and warfare against Indigenous peoples. This history isn't something that we can ignore. Everyone in Canada who's not an Indigenous person is an immigrant, a settler, who, because they live here, participates in the ongoing colonization of Indigenous peoples. And it's important to ground this evening's discussion in Canada's violent colonial history from its first to its present day colonizers. To talk about that a little more specifically, in 1876, the Indian Act was passed, and this act forced Native men and women to register with the government to prove their status as true Indians based on their ancestry. This process of registration allowed the government to keep track of registered Indigenous people. The Indian Act was also an attempt by the government to control Indigenous people. Native folks who proved that they were true Indians based on this criteria were denied the right to vote, and they were in effect not considered citizens of Canada. Indigenous people in Canada to this day are not considered part of the national community that needs to be kept secure. The numbers of Indigenous folk in prison today shows how much the government still considers them a threat, not a community that needs security. And for the record, to give you statistics, more than 20% of those imprisoned in Canada are Indigenous people, while Indigenous folk make up 3.6% of the country's population. And the control and exclusion of different groups of people by the government also appears in immigration policy. The 1885 head tax on Chinese immigrants, the internment of Japanese Canadians during World War II, and historical practices that discouraged African Americans from coming to Canada are all instances of exclusion and control of non-white immigrants. In 1952, a law was passed that gave immigration officials powers of selection, admission, and deportation on the grounds of nationality, ethnic group, peculiar customs, habits, and probable inability to become assimilated. Right up until the 1960s, race was a category that was explicitly considered in Canadian immigration policies. These policies have always gone hand in hand with preferential treatment of white immigrants, although who counts as white has changed over the years. Through its immigration policies and its treatment of Aboriginal people, Canada has made it clear that its preferred citizen is non-black, non-Asian, non-Indigenous, etc. By extending citizenship to white people while denying citizenship to non-white people in a lot of instances, although David Austin talked about how certain non-white immigrants who came to Canada and had a use value to the government were given citizenship, Canada, I would argue, constitutes itself as a white nation, and in doing so grants white people more space than non-white people. Real Canadian citizens are white, and others need to be immigrants and refugees first, and second-class Canadian citizens afterwards. And given the racist history of Canadian immigration, I would say that Islamophobia can be seen as the latest manifestation of a long historical process, and not, as David Austin also said, an entirely new phenomenon. There's a very clear way that Muslim people are racialized, especially through images in the media. And to give you a definition, racialized means to give a racial character to an attribute of a person. So on TV, Muslim people are mostly shown as South or West Asian brown-skinned men who are bearded and turbaned, and this racializes Islam by reducing a religion and an ideology to a snapshot of a non-white person decked out in symbols which are read as quintessentially Islamic. These images on TV erase the context and history of what it means to be Muslim by not showing the full breadth of people who identify as Muslim. And on top of that, the sheer number of images of brown-skinned South or West Asian men whose photos appear in the news with the caption terrorist presents terrorism as Islamic, which then racializes terrorism. This association between Islam and terrorism justifies the violence perpetrated against non-white people by the Canadian state. And here I also think it's necessary to talk about racial profiling, because the violence that I just mentioned is all wrapped up in racial profiling. Racial profiling is the inclusion of race as a primary reason for thinking a person is likely to commit a crime. Racial profiling works as a shorthand for list making. An individual who's coded as undesirable gets jammed into the category of terrorist for no other reason than what is perceived as their non-white self-presentation. So I would argue that it's no coincidence that Abu Sufyan's name ended up on the UN 1267 list. The targeting of the Muslim community through racial profiling that leads to surveillance and control and harassment by CSIS especially was only further solidified by the creation of the UN 1267 list in 1999. And the resolution that created that list doesn't even offer a definition of terrorism. and this lack of definition supports the conflation of Islam and terrorism, because the resolution singles out the Taliban and the state of Afghanistan for sanctions, and is also incredibly vague, as Khaled talked about, in terms of how people can get on the list and the whole idea of being associated with a certain organization or group or person. The resolution also uses the language of international security. Sometimes this is conflated with the global war on terror to globalize the phenomenon I talked about earlier. So if national security means that Canadians are divided into desirable and undesirable categories, then international security extends these categories to a global scale. And if national security is based on racist principles that justify violent harassment, detention, and deportation, then I can only expect international security to have the same foundation. Both national and international security policies rely on racial profiling, assumption of guilt by association, the targeting of specific communities, and a suspension of individuals' human rights. And none of these practices are new, and as David Austin said, it's really important to know the history here so that we can contextualize what's going on today, especially in terms of what's happening to Abu Sufyan.
State, the like a government of a country can do it. So if let's say Spain thought that I was a threat or that I was associated with, they could forward my name for listing, and then the committee would accept that request, look at it, and like very likely list me or whoever. Yeah, so that's how it works.
Mais est-ce qu'il existe une banque de données? Is there a data bank in Canada that focus sur les citoyens qui sont déviants d'une façon ou d'une autre par rapport aux normes sociales? Est-ce qu'il existe aussi une liste de no-flight qui est appliquée au Canada qui est distincte du régime 1267?
Yes.
Canadien.
Except for the flight control list? Yeah, the flight control list. Just en français, comment ça va? C'est flight control list, oui.
Et c'est fondé sur quelle fondation, quelle base, quelle information?
Honnêtement, je ne suis pas certain. Mary? Allez-y.
C'est pas une liste qui
est
par le nom.
Non.
Et c'est fondé sur quelle forme d'information, quelle forme de critères?
Ça, je sais pas.
Est-ce qu'on peut savoir qu'est-ce qui est inscrit sur la liste canadienne et où s'adresser pour avoir à ce moment-là des informations?
Je suis pas certain. Je peux, si tu veux, je peux demander et t'informer, mais je suis pas
j'aimerais
certain.
J'aimerais ça, OK. Merci.
Has anyone ever been removed off the 1267 list?
Yeah.
If so, how?
It has happened. There was actually one Canadian who was on the list and was taken off. His name was Liban Hussein. He was a Somali Canadian who ran a business transferring money from Canada to Somalia, I believe, through what's called a hawala, I think it was. So it's a, you know, like a Western Union kind of business, but to Somalia. And he was listed by 1267. committee, and eventually he hired some lawyers and brought an application to the federal court to challenge the Canadian implementation of 1267, those regulations that I was talking about. And in the course before that went to a hearing before the court, the government essentially lifted, they amended the regulations to lift their application from him. So they kind of exempted him from them, and then very soon after that, he was delisted. Again, how that decision happens, we don't know. What we do know unofficially is that in order for a delisting request to be accepted by the committee or to be seriously considered by the committee, a country needs to champion the request. It means a country has to do more than just submit it. Say, yeah, like our citizen X just wants to be delisted, here it is. If they've got to really like kind of a lobby for the delisting. So presumably the Canadian government did that in Lee Ban's case. Abu Sufyan has submitted a delisting request when he was in the Sudan, which was transmitted to the 1267 committee, but was denied. Again, we don't have reasons, but presumably Canada didn't champion the request. Incidentally, in the process of transmitting that request, the Department of Foreign Affairs requested or approached CSIS and the RCMP to see whether they had any reasons why Abu Sufyan should remain listed, and both of them said no. So essentially, he was cleared by security intelligence and law enforcement agencies, yet remains listed.
So you can only be put on by the state. And are people being put on the list like because racial profiling, because of their name? Like if their name sounds like a terrorist? Or
well, I mean, what I can tell you is that I think all of the people listed are Muslim.
Yeah.
Is it possible that someone's list? I mean, I don't know of a case where like it's just a random, yeah, that sounds like a terrorist name, so we're going to put you on. But there may very well be cases where someone's name, it resembles another person's name. And we hear this in the context of no-fly lists all the time, people who are given a little bit of extra attention at airports because your name looks like some. I have an acquaintance, actually, who has the same name as someone who's a suspected terrorist in Syria, I think. And he wants to travel to Egypt, which is his country of origin. And he's going through all kinds of hoops to ensure that once he gets to Egypt, he's not detained. And you know, so I mean, that does happen. In the context of 1267, I'm not sure of any specific examples.
So why is Lucifer on this list? Like, what did he do?
Pardon?
What did this guy do?
There's suspicions, right? Again, it's you're trying to prove a negative. What do I tell you? He didn't do it. I mean, like, tell me what he did, and I'll tell you. You know what I mean? Like, let us know the charge. Let us see the evidence, and we'll challenge that. But we don't have it, and that's the problem. So you've hit it with your question. That's the problem.
But also, it's important to remember that, like, where do these states get this information from when they go to the Security Council and ask for an individual to be put on the list? So, for example, here, CSIS was involved with Abu Sufyan's case, and, like, CSIS's surveillance is racist, and it's based on suspicion, it's based on targeting specific communities, and, yeah.
That raises a good point, actually, and I'll be quick on this. After the application was successful and Abu Sufyan was ordered to be repatriated, the United Nations, the 1267 committee, finally posted on its website some of the allegations against Abu Sufyan. And one of them says something about being associated with Abu Zubaydah, who is a high-ranking Al-Qaeda official. Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded, I think, nearly 100 times. You know what waterboarding is? Is anyone?
Yeah.
I mean, it's essentially where, I mean, it's a practice, it's a type of torture where you're essentially, you're covered, you're bound to some kind of, like a bed or something, and then water is poured on a particular portion of your face and it gives you the sensation that you're drowning. 3 seconds will drive you nuts, apparently. There was a reporter who didn't believe it, subjected himself to it, and now is a believer. Like, it's serious stuff, right? So when you're being waterboarded, not once, not twice, dozens or 100 times, well, you're going to give up, do you know this guy? Yeah, I know this guy, you know, whatever, right? You say what you need to say to get out of that situation, and that's the problem with a lot of the intel that's behind these listings.
So what I understand is that you can actually see the list, this, the 1267. That's with the no-fly list in the United States, you can't see it, and people don't know whether they're on it or not, and they... And I remember hearing someone speaking who had the same name as someone else, and the customs officer suggested he change his name.
There you have it.
So I'm guessing or hoping that if most of these lists or measures or whatever were in the public domain, that there'd be some kind of public uprising against it. I'm just wondering, is there any agency or organization that's acting towards keeping this kind of stuff suppressed, or are they just working on the basis that people are going to be ignorant towards it?
I think a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I mean, that's just my opinion. I know in the course of litigating some of these files, as Mr. Austin alluded to, we get documents that are like severely redacted. David. So we get documents that are severely redacted, and even as recently as yesterday, there was a release of documents in the Ahmed al-Mahdi case, which, you know, the government had said that certain documents were not to be disclosed because they were, disclosing them would be dangerous to the national security of Canada. And again, once that challenge was taken through the courts, it was determined that no, it wasn't in fact. So there's this practice that seems to be developing in security intelligence community to just over-redact things. And so that's one of the reasons I think that we don't see a lot of this stuff. It's just hidden. But also I think, you know, kind of apathy and things like that also play into it.
And also the role that the media plays in portraying people as terrorists and, like, perpetuating the global war on terror. Like, that's really involved in upholding this regime. But maybe we'll take a couple questions and then you guys can answer together.
Oui, je voulais juste revenir à la question qui a été posée. Dans le fond, il y a plus qu'un Soudanais au Canada. Pourquoi lui particulièrement? Moi, ça reste pas clair dans ma tête pourquoi lui a été. Tu sais, il doit avoir. C'est basé seulement sur des suspicions, mais quelles sont-elles?
On ne sait pas. Comme, c'est quoi les suspicions? C'est qu'il est associé avec Abu Zubaydah, il a voyagé différents pays. Des choses qui sont pas vraies, premièrement, mais on n'a pas vu les preuves. Ça, c'est des allégations, mais les allégations doivent être basées sur des preuves. C'est quoi les preuves? On ne sait pas. On n'a pas vu encore. On demande. On n'a jamais reçu. Fait que c'est ça un des problèmes avec le système de régime.
Mais
là,
est-ce
que
le
national
a fermé ses yeux, a pointé quelqu'un? Ils ont construit un dossier d'allégations fausse ou non prouvée sur le cas de n'importe qui.
Il faudrait demander au Conseil de sécurité. Disons, on essaie.
Je pense aussi que ça nous ramène tout au point qui a été expliqué tout au long de la présentation de M. Aussi, notamment, c'est genre cette idée-là que finalement le gouvernement veut empêcher la dissension sociale, la protestation, et par ça, va mettre en place un système pour faire en sorte que les classes au pouvoir, les groupes dominants, puis les élites conservent leur pouvoir. C'est un peu comme ça que ça fonctionne en l'instant. Donc à ce moment-là, le service de renseignement va contribuer à maintenir ce système-là en place. Et dans la situation présente, quand on sait que tant le CRS que la GRC ont blanchi son nom, ils ont vraiment émis des documents, des communiqués en disant « mais nous, on ne fait rien pour cette personne-là », pourquoi ça continue? C'est Ce que nous, on amène, c'est l'idée qu'il soit bouc émissaire. C'est vraiment cette idée-là, c'est de, parce que là, sa situation, elle permet de servir les politiques du gouvernement canadien. Elle lui sert ses politiques en gardant cette personne-là isolée, puis en pensant que, bon, il va pas s'organiser. Puis, voilà, tout ce système-là se maintient en place par des mécanismes comme ça.
I think those two questions about why kind of speaks to what I was trying to say earlier. That I think the questions themselves conform to a certain logic, which I don't mean this in a negative sense. I don't mean this in a directness towards either of you, but I think the logic is misplaced itself. Because I think from what I was trying to suggest in my discussion, innocent people, many innocent people, were spied upon in the 60s and 70s, right, for ideas, beliefs, and practices which are normalized today. But we know this 30 years later. So I think you're looking for answers that may not exist, right? But framed by this idea of Canada, the state, the good, right? And I think that's what has to be rethought. Because it doesn't conform to how people who are citizens or non-citizens, because the category of citizen itself, but I mean everybody should be treated equally, right? It doesn't conform to how some people are treated, you know, for whatever reasons, but those reasons are not necessarily legal or illegal. And I think if we're able to kind of break that framework, you know, some of this makes a bit more sense. And I just wanted to add something. You know, one of the people that's mentioned, but whose name is not, who's being described in these documents as a member of this group, and I won't mention his name, is still alive and very active and does a lot of work in the Caribbean. And very recently, right, and he's a Canadian citizen,